From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Coming up this week, we look at whether the passage of the state budget means the end of the legislative session. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, shares his thoughts on the governor's reaction to a New York Times editorial criticizing his free college tuition plan. And as some communities around the state become sanctuary cities, Schenectady appears to be distancing itself from that label. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. Did the passage of the state budget in New York signal an end of Albany's legislative session for 2017, or will other matters, including ethics reform, get done before lawmakers adjourn in June? The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt takes a look.
Cuomo says the recently enacted state budget included the majority of the priorities that he named in his January State of the State message, including raising the age for adult criminal responsibility from 16 to 18, providing free public college tuition for some middle-class families, and allowing ride-hailing services to operate outside New York City. As for other topics, like ethics reform, the governor says it was left out of the final budget package for a reason.
If we didn't get it done in the budget, it means you don't have the political will to get it done. Ethics reform, for example, I don't see that happening with this legislature.
Cuomo's economic development projects, including the Buffalo Billion, were the target of a federal corruption probe. It's led to the arrest of 9 former Cuomo associates, including the governor's former closest aide. Trials begin later this year. The governor's remarks, made at an Easter egg hunt at the executive mansion, are a change from what Cuomo said in late March when asked about the chances for ethics reform.
We're going to try like heck.
Cuomo also, in those mid-March statements, took a different view of whether the budget is the sole means to get key policy items passed into law.
The budget is primarily about finances. If there's a policy matter that is related to the finances, then I try to include it because the budget is a good vehicle to reconcile as much as you can. Many of the democracy issues that you talk about, we're going to take up after the budget.
John Caney, with the government reform group Reinvent Albany, says he's not worried that the governor seems to be giving up on ethics reform for now.
The governor also said, and I will quote him, at least if this is reported accurately, quote, I will respond
to the initiatives that the legislature comes up with.
Caney, with Reinvent Albany, says the measure known as the Procurement Integrity Act has support in the Democratic-led Assembly as well as the Senate. GOP Deputy Majority Leader John DeFrancisco is a key sponsor. The bill would reinstate the state controller's authority to review economic development contracts. Those powers were taken away in a 2011 law. Caney says many other lawmakers are also interested in the measures.
The question before the Capitol and before Albany and the legislature is, are they going to fix a gigantic problem that was revealed last year when $800 million in state economic development contracts were apparently rigged and 9 people were arrested by federal and state prosecutors, including close aides to the governor? And that problem has not been fixed yet.
The governor has offered his own reforms. Instead of giving the controller back oversight powers, Cuomo would set up a special inspector general as part of his administration to oversee economic development contracts. The governor says he does believe there is more work to do when it comes to ethics reform. In the meantime, Cuomo says instead of negotiating with the legislature at the Capitol, he plans to focus instead on building infrastructure, including airports, roads, and bridges, and the long-awaited upgrade of New York City's Penn Station.
We have these large projects to get done. I want to make sure they get done.
And the governor says he wants to make sure that they get done on time. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Well, this week began with an editorial in the New York Times. We witnessed criticism of Governor Andrew Cuomo's free college tuition program with an asterisk in the editorial next to free. They sort of picked it apart and said it's not all that it's cracked up to be. That was followed by a response from the governor, Ken Lovett, who you talked to this week from the New York Daily News, was at the Easter egg roll at the mansion where he asked the governor about it, and the governor was not happy with the Times. Alan, you pick it up from there.
I don't think he was happy with the Times, and I don't think he's happy with Ken Lovett in the Daily News.
Right.
He gives him hell on a regular basis. Also, you know, his reaction was interesting because there's an old saying about not getting into fights with people in the press. It's a little bit more colorful than that, but let's leave it alone for now. And going after the Times and saying, basically, look, the Times doesn't lie me, the Times doesn't lie my father. We wouldn't be the governor if you read the New York Times, but we were. And are, and he really let them have it. And of course, when that happens, there's always a certain amount of joy in Timesville, I'm sure. The Times has been properly critical of Cuomo. I don't think that the Times is always right, but in this case, I think the Times was right. It picked apart the program. It showed that, for example, you had to stay in the state for 4 years after you graduated from college if you took the money. It said so many things that one would raise their eyebrow about. So you think that the newspapers do their job? They were doing their job. And Cuomo, of course, was counting on this to be part of his national legacy, obviously, so that he can run for president of the United States and claim quite correctly that it's the first one that has done it this way in the country. And that's part of his progressive agenda that is designed to, as we say, tack left. A sailing term in order to get the left wing that supported Bernie Sanders and others. And he's had Bernie Sanders out there with him basically endorsing this. And it is exactly what he wants to do to get to be president. When the Times decides to take a proper look at what he has done, there's a certain amount of angst on his part. It's not good form. We see that exact form with Donald Trump when he attacks the Times, calls it the failing newspaper and all the rest of it. And I noticed in the Times something that I thought was very interesting. They now have a way that people can contribute to support subscriptions for people who can't afford them. Fascinating. For young people, that's fascinating. An interesting way from the public radio way of doing things that the Times is now heading.
Well, let's go from there to perhaps something else that's giving Governor Cuomo some angst, and that has to do with his memoir, All Things Possible. We learned after he released his taxes that he doubled his salary, and he has made a total of $783,000 on a memoir that only sold 3,200 copies. That had Tom Precious of the Buffalo News asking, how do you make that kind of money after selling only 3,200 copies?
Now, I know this is going to sound bad, and I'm sorry for sounding this way, but David, you were with me when I did it. I interviewed Mario Cuomo for many, many years, probably a record breaker, and I wrote a book called Me and Mario about the radio show. And I didn't make, I think, one penny out of the whole thing. And I know how this is going to sound, but it was a much better book. So what can I say? Who was the publisher of the ultimate publisher, the owner of the publishing company? Was it? Well, it was Rupert Murdoch. You know, there are all kinds of transactions in government, but here is Murdoch. And interesting, Ken Lovett reminded me of this the other day. There was supposed to be a biography of Cuomo that Fred Dicker had gotten with the same company, Dicker of the Post. It was going to be a negative hit. I don't think there's any doubt about it to most of us. It was going to be scathing. So anyway, Cuomo apparently was concerned about this, went to HarperCollins and said, hey, so why don't I do an autobiography? You'll print it. And the Dicker book never came out. Interesting, huh?
From there to what is now the first female secretary to the governor in New York, Melissa DeRosa, named this week, and some conflicts of interest coming along with it.
Well, everybody in DeRosa's family is connected to lobbying firms or to other things that are conflictive with what is happening in state government. She says she's staying out of all of that, but how do you get a chief of staff, basically? That was her old title. The new title is the top person, secretary to the governor, and say, okay, she's going to eliminate all conflicts of interest, like Donald Trump and like Ivanka saying they're going to eliminate all kinds of conflicts of interest. It's very hard to do. Look, there are many people who have great respect for Melissa DeRosa. She does a good job. She works hard. She's bright. But, of course, it raises all kinds of interesting questions that when you're that connected, that somehow there isn't a perception on people's parts that if they do this or that. Look, if you know anything about lobbying in Albany, and I do, I've studied it, I've taught it in a graduate course for years. It's fascinating because the more connected a person, a lobbyist, is to the candidates themselves, the more business those firms get. Hey, people aren't stupid. They say, well, this guy is a friend of Shelley Silver's. Good. So then Shelley Silver's favorite lobbyist firm gets the business. Shelley Silver leaves, not so much. And it isn't anybody's fault. The laws allow it. So that's just the way that it works.
Legislative Gazette political observer Ellen Chartok. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. A crash last week in Rockland County involving a CSX train that hit a car carrying a trailer stuck on the tracks has U.S. Senate Minority Leader Charles Schumer calling on the feds to take action. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn has more.
While the CSX train involved in the accident last week was not carrying crude oil, New York Senator Schumer said the tracks are no stranger to trains that do carry crude.
We were lucky at Wednesday's accident, but it should be a shot across the bow. It should be a warning shot.
The Democrat says it's time for two federal departments to expedite a rule to make flammable crude oil less volatile before it is shipped.
I am asking that our Department of Transportation require oil companies to stabilize the highly flammable oil that is in the oil cars before it comes through Rockland County and all of New York State.
And Schumer's ask also goes to the U.S. Department of Energy. Republican Rockland County Executive Ed Day says close calls should lead to higher safety standards.
Is it going to take a tragedy for it to happen? We have not had a tragedy in New York State yet. We've had near misses, yes. Why do we have to wait for a tragedy, for lives to be lost to get something done? This is what frustrates the senator,
exactly
right. Our elected officials, our first responders, and myself. There's no reason for this.
In addition to the Haverstraw accident, there was a CSX train derailment in Newburgh in March. And while that train was not carrying crude oil, it was carrying hazardous materials, including sulfuric acid, and derailed along the Hudson River near a major oil terminal. In both cases, there were no injuries, and in Newburgh, no leaks. Again, Schumer.
The derailments and explosions and deaths in Lynchburg, Virginia, in Lac Mégantic in Canada, in Charleston, West Virginia, Aliciaville, Alabama, and Castleton, North Dakota all had one thing in common. They were carrying this lighter, more volatile Bakken crude.
The Haverstraw incident occurred just outside the window of Bill Stein's law office, where he has been since 1981.
I was sitting in my office, which is right next to the tracks, and all of a sudden I started to hear sounds of cracking wood, and I couldn't imagine what it was. And then I looked out the window, and then I saw two trucks going right next to my window, probably about 2 or 3 feet from where I'm sitting. I had no idea what they were. I thought they were some part of the CSX train. And then once I figured out what happened, I realized that there had been an incident where a car carrier had been sideswiped, and it carried the cars all along the building and snapping our rafters each step of the way.
He says there was no damage inside. County Executive Day says not only did the accident miss Stein, but a gas line as well. And Day wants to see another change.
I'm calling upon CSX to exercise common sense and recognize that when you have highly flammable or volatile transport, to slow down.
Schumer also has called on CSX to reduce its speed limit in all heavily populated areas, including Rockland, and vows to keep the pressure on CSX to effect this change. A CSX spokesman in an emailed statement says, in part, quote, CSX already operates trains transporting crude oil at reduced speeds in accordance with regulations established by the U.S. Department of Transportation. And CSX will continue to comply with all federal regulations regarding the safe transport of this and all freight consigned to us, end quote. A request for comment from the USDOT was not returned in time for this broadcast. After stopping in Rockland, Schumer was headed to Kingston to call on CSX to find another area to park idling trains. He then visited Poughkeepsie to urge the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to expedite approvals for a riverfront dock expansion project.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
As some communities in the state establish themselves as sanctuary cities, Schenectady appears to be distancing itself from the label as it considers its options. The Schenectady City Council this week had been discussing immigration, a hot topic that has drawn dozens of residents at recent meetings. We take a closer look with the Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard.
The topic of immigration has been a hot-button issue lately in Schenectady, as it is nationally. Those for and against measures addressing immigration have appeared in large numbers at public meetings. The City Council is now in a position where it seeks to address immigration without adopting the label Sanctuary City, a term used in areas where local authorities have agreed to limit their cooperation with federal agencies. City Council President Lisa Peraza, who called for Monday night's discussion, made that distinction.
We have long come to the fact that the majority of the council does not feel comfortable with that, so nobody at this table is recommending that.
What is on the table? Three separate bills addressing immigration that Peraza hoped would establish common ground. The most popular option is a simplified document brought forward by a majority of four Democrats that calls on the federal government to enact comprehensive immigration reform. Councilmember Ed Kosher said that the plan is based on language developed by the U.S. Conference of Mayors and nearly mirrors language adopted by Orlando, Florida.
Working, again, with the Conference of Mayors, this proposal that they worked on for comprehensive immigration reform, I think, is very, very important. It's a good starting point. Certainly the conversation should and will continue, I'm sure, in our community.
The resolution it is based on was signed onto by Schenectady Mayor Gary McCarthy, as well as the mayors of Albany, Syracuse, and Rochester. The proposed resolution does not mention the city police department or community policing, but acknowledges the importance of immigrants to the local economy and city diversity. It also says the city would work to, quote, foster a welcoming and secure city for all of their residents, regardless of who they are or where they came from, unquote. Vince Riggi, the only independent on the seven-member board dominated by Democrats, agreed with Kosher's sentiment that it's the city's duty to support law enforcement and to uphold federal laws.
I put my hand on the Bible, as all of us did, and we swore to uphold the Constitution and the laws of the United States of America. Now, that's important when you do that. It isn't anything else. It's an important thing. That's what we do, and I take that very seriously. And I don't think we should be telling our police department to go against anything that the federal government is going to request.
Councilmember Marion Porterfield is seeking a bill that would include language stating that the city police department, quote, has long held to the practice that it does not inquire into a person's immigration status upon initial contact, unquote.
So it's not saying to the police, don't do anything. It's just what the police chief, what the mayor has said, what's been said consistently. That's a statement. It's not trying to tie the hand of the police.
Peraza said while it's nice that the Conference of Mayors put together the language used in the majority-supported proposal, she sought to tie in the sentiment of community members and personalize her own bill that would proclaim Schenectady a welcoming city.
I have never seen the likes of that, not even for the casino. And the missing voice of our citizens in this resolution, I find very, very disappointing.
The next regularly scheduled City Council meeting is set for Monday, April 24th.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
You're listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Several hundred officials from across the North Country gathered last week in Lake Placid to hear Governor Andrew Cuomo discuss highlights of the recently passed state budget. The fiscal plan includes $2.5 billion for statewide clean water infrastructure and $13.2 million in aid to municipalities. The spending plan keeps the Environmental Protection Fund at $300 million. The New York State's Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner Basil Segos told the Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley it's the best environmental budget the state has passed in three decades.
We saw enormous cutbacks in the late 2000s to DEC's budget, parks budget. You know, we were talking at one point, obviously, about parks being closed and shuttered. This year, with not only a $300 million EPF, but really the centerpiece of this budget being this $2.5 billion for clean water, will truly be transformational statewide. It's going to give us the resources we need to protect health, to protect drinking water. It's going to give us the resources to set land aside in conjunction with towns and nonprofits. For us, it gives us everything we were asking for and much more. So I think in stark contrast to what you see happening in Washington, we're going the other direction, in fact. We're embracing the environment. We're embracing environmental protection. The governor recognizes that, you know, the key to a strong economy is protecting and safeguarding your natural assets. And that's really what's sustainable over time.
Well, the EPF is not just the natural assets, but as you mentioned, the towns, villages, communities, and their water sewer infrastructure. Over the past few years and with this budget, how much has the state helped those communities with that aspect?
Well, an enormous amount. The EPF, just when we came in, was $134 million. Now it's $300 million. All of that is getting out to communities. And, you know, in every community, we spend a dollar of EPF. That's $7 in total project cost. So it's clean water, it's drinking water, it's land preservation, it's fighting invasive species. It's making an enormous difference. I mean, that is, if you look at the total leveraging just on the EPF side, we're talking well over $1 billion over time. The clean water money we put in the budget over the last 2 years has already leveraged well over $1 billion in project costs. And now with this new $2.5 billion, we're looking at probably a leveraging over $10 billion. That will really chip into this backlog that we've all been talking about of, you know, $50 billion of need. Now New York State is finally addressing it.
How important are New York State's policies and the budget that we now have in relation to the federal policies and what's happening at the federal EPA?
Oh, I think it is vitally important. The actions we're taking right now, we are going to hold the line against any potential cuts at the federal level. It's not to say we don't need a federal partner. We have always needed a strong federal partner to carry out environmental protection in New York. We've had that since the birthplace of the environmental movement when those laws were first passed and the billions of dollars that the state has gotten over that time. Now we're talking about draconian cuts that make no sense. Clean air and water are bipartisan issues. They're in fact nonpartisan issues. We should be alarmed about what's being proposed out of Washington. New York State has decided to stand up against that by making our own investments, by protecting our own assets. But we do need a federal partner to carry that out.
Well, how much in New York State is at risk from the cuts at the EPA?
We get an enormous amount of money from the EPA, direct grants to administer federal programs, $188 million. Any cutback of that means real questions at the DEC as to our ability to carry out their programs. So we're going to fight back hard against that.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies are available. Call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1715 or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.